Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. Good to have you back with us. We are about to have a conversation about the issue of sexual assault in the military. You know, there's been a lot in the news, has been for quite a while, but it seems there's been an explosion of news that has grabbed people's consciousness, wanting to figure out what is going on. Just as example, 2 weeks ago, Air Force Colonel Jeff Krasinski, who is Chief of Sexual Assault Prevention and Response, was charged with sexual battery in Arlington, Virginia. It made people wake up. And just right after that, last week, an Army sergeant in Fort Hood, who worked as a sexual prevention and response coordinator, had similar charges, allegations of pandering and abusive sexual contact, assault and maltreatment of subordinates. And then Lieutenant Carol Darren Haas, the head of sexual assault response at Fort Campbell in Kentucky, turned himself in because he violated a restraining order in a domestic violence dispute with his ex-wife. And then this morning's paper, Sergeant First Class Michael McClendon from the Military Academy was accused of videotaping female cadets in showers and in bathrooms and other places at the academy. And so people begin to ask themselves a question. Once you've seen other reports come out that we'll talk about during the course of this conversation, is there something really within military culture where this kind of hypersexuality, misogyny is just part, not to say just, but is part of the culture, part of any military culture anywhere? Is it something deeper than that? Or where is it? This morning, as I had the conversation with my wife leaving the door, the house, she said to me, you know, when you look at issues like this and misogyny, that racism is one of the most horrible things that ever hit the planet Earth. But it was a creation of European capitalism and creating this racist attitude, which has been horrendous for the African diaspora and others in our world. But misogyny, the war against women, is in every culture, every nation, everywhere, and is being brought to the fore because women are coming to the fore now, and things have erupted, and maybe they're just more in our consciousness. So we're going to wrestle with all that. We have with us Captain Lori Manning. She's a retired U.S. Navy captain. She's project director for the Women's Research and Education Institute's Women – did I say that right? Women's Research and Education Institute Women in the Military Project.
That's right.
I'm sorry.
No, you got it.
Good, good. Dr. Bruce Fleming, who's joined us before, professor in the Department of English at the U.S. Naval Academy. Dr. Marion Githens here in the studio. She's Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Women, Gender, and Sexual Studies at Goucher College here in Baltimore. And Greg Jacob, Policy Director for the Service Women's Action Network, SWAN. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump on our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner and the Mark Steiner Show, to join in on this conversation. And I know a lot of our listeners are military personnel. A lot of our listeners have served in the military. And we'd love to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888 about all of this. So, Captain Manning, let me just ask you first. I mean, let's just look at it in a broad sense for a moment. Is there something inherent in military culture that that kind of perpetuates this?
Well, one of the things that the military has is a very high concentration of young men. And I think it's sort of a lot of it is inherent in worldwide in that age group. Beyond that, it's certainly something I encountered every step of the 25 years that I was in the military. Not just sexual assault, but plain old sexism. There it is. And the military certainly encouraged or didn't stop feeding the itch, so to speak. But when I was in the Navy along a pole, which was sort of the bar area in the Philippines right outside the big Navy base at Subic Bay, was glorified. And the military just sort of looked at it as, well, these guys need an outlet. So, it's pretty inherent in there.
I really kind of probe that even more deeply with all of you, what you just said, Captain Loring. And Bruce Fleming, good to have you back with us.
Thank you very much.
Your perspective on that. I mean, you wrote, I was reading the email you sent to us, which I found very fascinating. I'll ask you some very specific questions about it. What's your take?
Well, first of all, we have to make some distinctions. Behavior like the sergeant major photographing female cadets is completely a no-go, obviously, because that violates the rules against frat. You don't have any sexual relations with people who are under your charge, and clearly they were under his charge. So my concern is to be able to make distinctions like that and to have zero tolerance for behavior for which we should have zero tolerance. What I'm very leery about are the larger generalizations that say, you know, men should completely bottle up their sexuality and there should be no outlets. Actually, I kind of have to agree that they do need an outlet, so I'm going to go against the captain a little bit on that one. It is certain whether or not you believe that military action, which is based on force and aggressivity, is an intrinsically male trait. Most people in our society, I think, would agree with that. But even if you don't agree with that, it is true that the 19 and 20-year-old kids that come into that largely buy into it. It's not just because they're young men. It's because they do see the military as an expression of their masculinity. And masculinity is all of one piece. You know, it's aggression against an enemy, but it also is related to, I won't call it sexual aggressivity, but taking the first step or being the assumption being that the man is supposed to go after the woman and all that kind of stuff. So we can't separate them. So it's not okay to say to the man, don't be a man, because they are deeply invested in their masculinity. And I think our society wants them to be that invested in their masculinity because it feeds into their perception of themselves in the military. I mean, after 26 years at the Naval Academy, I'm here to tell you that, you know, all the hard-charging ones, the ones that go SEALs, the ones that go Marine Grounds and so on, their own masculinity is their most prized possession. So we're not well advised to give them the signals that that is a no-go. We need to encourage that, but also have zero tolerance for what I'm saying, at people, women who are, or anybody who are under their responsibility. And I'll pause there because that one is the huge one. We're doing a horrible job of training them because we don't make those distinctions.
And I think you both, we're going to turn to other guests here just to get the perspective of everybody's perspective, but what you both have just raised, I think, are key issues in some ways people might think are contradictory. And so I want to probe this in a much deeper way after we get through this round of openings. And let me turn next to Dr. Marion Githens. Your thoughts on what you just heard and what you think about military culture as a whole.
Well, in the first place, I'm here, I assume, because I'm involved in gender studies programs. As a matter of fact, I founded the program out at Goucher College, and I've written 4 books on women and their role in society, plus innumerable articles. But I have another qualification that I don't believe Mark Steiner knows, and that is that my stepdaughter went to the United States Merchant Marine Academy. She was one of the earliest women graduates from there. And I can tell you that the tradition of disregard for women and misogyny was clearly there. In her class, for example, they had such a hard time that the women finally went, where did they, what was their lounge? It was the women's room, because they could go into the toilet and the men didn't come in there, but every place else they were sexually harassed. I don't know whether, Captain, that was part of your experience, but I know certainly that was my stepdaughter's experience.
Well, no 2 or 3 ought to be seen together in a group back in those days without the men saying, what are you plotting?
So,
But
I think beyond that, to say they're young men is, first of all, the one who was head of the harassment program wasn't a young man. So I don't think we can account for that. I don't think we have the same sets of complaints at coeducational colleges that women are complaining. Some women perhaps complain, but a lot of them are having an enjoyable life. But that does not tie into what you're talking about, Mr. Fleming, Professor Fleming, because what we're really talking about, and I hate the expression, he just doesn't get it, or she just doesn't get it. But I don't think we just don't get it. This is really about power. That's what it's about. that's what gives the makes the problem. And when you just can't talk about everybody having sex with everybody else in the military in the same way as you can at a four-year college or a four-year university, because those students that went to university or college come out, they may see each other 10 years later for a reunion, but it's not likely that more than maybe a very few see each other on a regular basis or have any kind of professional interaction with each other ever again. And that's not true at Annapolis. That's not true at West Point. That was certainly not true at Kings Point. So you're really talking about something very different.
Let me go to Greg Jacob for his opening thoughts, and then we'll come back. Greg?
Yeah, I would echo that statement about this really being a power issue. I mean, specifically with the issue of sexual assault in the military, if you look at the numbers that come out of the Sexual Assault Prevention Response Office year after year, it's evident that men are assaulted just as much, if not more, as women. Last year, the numbers indicated that men were assaulted more. The percentages are less, but the total number of men in the military drive that number way, way up. I spent 10 years in the Marines as an infantry officer and 4 years as an enlisted infantry Marine. And I think what we have to distinguish here is that there's a difference between criminal activity and unprofessional behavior. And the military has done a very poor job of drawing a bright line between those two. So, you know, when we're talking about men needing an outlet, or we're talking about boys will be boys, or we're talking about young men, you know, consuming alcohol with women around and these types of issues, that in no way really condones or should condone what is clearly criminal activity. And that is ultimately what gets to the bottom of the issue of good order and discipline within the military. And that's why this issue of sexual assault is so difficult, first of all, for the military to handle, is because they're not dealing with it correctly in the correct context. And second of all, is why it's so nefarious, and that it gets to the core of trust within the unit, which is really what establishes the ability for the unit to move forward and accomplish its missions.
Well, the comments, by the way, that some young women have talked about, you know, I don't report it. Why report it? You know, they'll hold it against me. It'll affect my career, blah, blah, blah. I think, you know, there again, we're really talking about issues of power, the professional career.
Well, let me just kind of push some issues here. So I think we've said some interesting stuff here. I want to hear what our guests think, our listeners think at 410-319-8888. Is there a place where what you were saying, Dr. Bruce Fleming,
yes,
and what some of the other guests were saying may actually not be that different? In that, we do, whether you both, Greg and Lori, you both served, and Bruce, you've been at the Naval Academy for a long, long time.
That's right.
When you're in the service, you are trained to be aggressive. You're trained, and you are training young men. You used to just train young men to go out there and fight and be aggressive. You see that, you know, that whenever we have this, even in our high schools and in colleges, where a lot of the attitude of young star athletes, male athletes, is not dissimilar in terms and what happens in those circumstances. So, is there a link between that aggression and the misogyny that already exists that fuels sexual assault? And B, if that's true or not true, how do you address it? Let me go to Bruce and then Laurie first, well, and then go to Greg, and then back to Marianne.
The military, I would say that the military has to lay off a very long tradition that it has of adopting a moral stance towards sexuality. If you look at the UCMJ, you'll see all sorts of stuff in there that don't clearly have anything to do with aggressing people, women in particular, who are in your chain of command and for whom you're responsible. They're in the process of getting rid, for example, of the ban on sodomy. My understanding is it's not gone yet, but that's left over from Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Once they got rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they realized they had to get rid of that. But, of course, that can refer to oral sex as well. Anything that's so-called conduct unbecoming is grounds for dismissal and so on. The Fort Jackson thing is not her sexual harassment within the chain of command. So at the Naval Academy, at all service academies, for example, there's no sex whatsoever, and that starts with hand-holding. So for 4 years, these hormone-charged young men and women at West Point, at Air Force, at King's Point, at Annapolis are supposed to have zero sex, which is ridiculous, ridiculous. So I would say that we've painted with too broad a brush, and it makes us unable to target the behavior which needs to be targeted. So we need to give up on this idea that we can police morality. That one we just have to take a step back from. And we have to say, well, what is it that really concerns us? And the answer is, now that there are more women, and that's an answer to an implicit earlier question, which is why now, women are being integrated fast and furious. So we as a society have decided that that's a very high priority. But what we haven't done is address within the military the effects of doing that. So I think that we need to stop yelling at the men, basically. I mean, I know exactly what my students and what people in the fleet say when they go to yet another one of these sexual assault training, so-called training sessions. I've been to them all. And the bottom line is always men are horrible, they're always out for the women, and the guys just roll their eyes. So none of the training is effective, and we cast a net that's way too broad. So we have to be specific about what it is that we're talking about, which is, I don't have time to go into my what I call no-fly zones, but basically any man can be trained to be protective of women that he's supposed to be responsible for. And that's what we need to be focused on, not this blanket disapproval of sexuality, not this blanket disapproval of masculinity.
So I'm sorry, Bruce, I just wanted to just make sure your listeners get in here before we get to the phones. Lori and Greg, would you jump in? Lori, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to re-echo or repeat what Greg said. One of the key problems in the military is defining that bright line between what is a crime and what is people being people. And I do agree that the military is way too into condemning all sex. Sex happens between people, and as long as it's consensual and not within the chain of command, we need to stop court-martialing people for that sort of thing. I would take exception to blaming the integration of women for sexual assault. There are women who served in World War II, in World War I, and the problem goes back to that, and we've had 65 years of gradually integrating women in a very slow pace into more and more duties and units. They've been serving in combat aboard ships and air squadrons for 20 years now. The pattern for how to do this successfully is out there, and I'm hoping as we begin gradually integrating them into combat units that the Army, Marine Corps, Special Forces will look at how the Navy and all the services dealt with integrating women into aviation and shipboard combat. You can't blame women for this. You can blame the training. I agree with Professor Fleming. The sexual assault training is dismal. I've rolled my eyes when I've had to go through it. It doesn't get at the problem.
So Greg, what gets at the problem? What do you think gets at the problem?
I think a lot of this is a leadership issue. I mean, you know, Marines, but members of the military, you know, they're trained to be aggressive, you know, but they're also trained to be disciplined. They're also trained to obey. And the officers and the non-commissioned officers also trained to lead. So somewhere, if there's a breakdown somewhere in that chain and this aggressive behavior, you know, the dogs are off the leash all the time, then that's a problem for that the leadership has to address. And your leadership, you know, my priorities as a Marine commander were troop welfare and mission accomplishment. And I was taught that, you know, you can't accomplish a mission unless you're taking care of your troops. And you can't take care of your troops unless you're accomplishing your mission. So, I mean, it all goes hand in glove. But, yeah, the training that's been mentioned before is death by PowerPoint. You're fed with a fire hose. They're just now starting to get to more scenario-based training, more role-playing, you know, the types of things that adult learning and adult educators have been pushing for a long, long time. But the real core problem with the training is that it doesn't focus on it doesn't focus on the crime. It doesn't focus on the perpetrator. It focuses on the victim. It focuses on the potential victim. And it really, the language and the messaging and the military training goes back to what we were hearing in society or in the 1970s and 1980s about not wearing a skirt and not going out alone at night and keeping a rape whistle around your neck and these other kinds of things that really just have been proven to be ridiculous. So the military needs to really get a grip on this issue of criminality, prosecuting these crimes, because it's much more effective for them to draw a bright, shining line in the training and tell troops that, hey, if you do this, you will get caught, you will get prosecuted, you'll go to jail, and you'll get thrown out of the military, than it is for them to deliver messaging around, you know, the individual conduct of a potential sexual assault victim.
So before we turn back to Marion Githens, let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888, some of our listeners. And Mark, in Baltimore, you're on the air. Mark, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you. I'm retired Navy, and I remember my days as a youth in the Navy, being out to sea and you know, what that was like for a young man in an all-male environment. You know, you really can't compare the college environment to the military environment because the percentage of men is much greater. So when you're on a ship and you are, you know, and you're away from society and you at days and weeks and months at a time, the sexual frustration for a young man, especially at his peak, is crushing. So that when he does get back into the general public, okay, it is, you know, like a person pretty much on fire. And so what the Navy is doing now as far as integrating women into the Navy, that's going to help, you know, I should say, level, make things more balanced, where people can, you know, have relationships and not be taken away from their natural functions in life. Because in a college campus, you can pretty much bet those kids they're not just studying. But in the military mission, where you are basically isolated and away, you know, away from people and things like that, you know, you're expected to, of course, be a man. But then when you get in the presence of you know, normal female company, it's a different feeling, you know. And I don't know if our panel can even relate to that.
Well, so very quickly, Mark, let me ask you a very quick question. So what about the women on the ship who served with you?
Okay, now I was on a ship. My last ship was there was I was there when they brought. I was there when let me tell you. I was there when they brought the first women aboard, and it was, you know, it was interesting. You know, everybody was excited about it, and you know, basically the biggest problems we had were, you know, duties. You know, and that was pretty much, you know, that they're gonna work just like we were, you know, and that was the only problem I saw at that time. I was there for like 8 months before I had to move, come eastward, back east.
Okay.
But outside of that, I think the guys on the ship and the women on the ship sort of like, they became like buddies. And I'm going to tell you, the women could stand toe to toe with you as far as trash talk. And so it was, you know, it was really not that big of an issue. It's just that when it became, when you got some people that go overboard.
Mark, I appreciate all the insight you have as a Navy man bringing this to the thought. And we only have 2.5 minutes. We have to go to break. But I'd like some quick comments. And I think, let me see, Marianne, we haven't heard from you. A quick response, but I also want to hear what Laurie Manning has to say, is also a former Navy person.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say, you can go back a long time. There's a very interesting book that's just been published on American troops' behavior in France during the First World War. And a lot of letters and material has come to the fore and is reprinted in the book, which suggests that sexual assault was pretty common then. So I think to say, you know, this is something new and it's just because now women are in the military and haven't been, we haven't thought enough about integrating them is really poppycock, if I may use that expression. I'd like to use something more, but I'll say poppycock. You know, it's a real culture. And when you talk about, you know, men and young men and sexual desires and so forth, I think also in being prepared, I think maybe we really need to talk about is not to talk about in these sex training things that go on. And they're, and by the way, at any place, they're really awful and students hate them. But I think it's really something about what are appropriate gender roles. That's what should be taken care of.
What?
Maybe that, you know, that men aren't just supposed to be mean, kill, maim, defend, protect in general populations, and that's only the male role. Maybe, and women's role is to be there to be available for sexual activity. I mean, that's, I think, what we really need. If we really want to have good training, that's the kind of training.
I'm sorry, we have to go to break here. We're going to come back. And the book you're referring to is about World War II.
Yeah. No, World War I.
No, it's what women, it just came out, What Soldiers Do by Mary Louise Roberts. It's about what happened after D-Day with sexual assaults against French women that has just come to light.
It's an earlier one on World War I.
Okay, we'll take a quick break. We're going to come right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner as we examine sexual assault in the military. Why is it happening? There have been one study we were looking at earlier was actually a book that was written a couple of years back that really kind of hit in some ways. As I was reading it again, it was a testimony by Representative Jane Harman when she was a congresswoman. July 2008 this was at a House panel where she talked about a study showing that 4 out of 10 women who were patients at the Veterans Hospital had been raped, not in the hospital, been raped during their service. One of the quotes in the book is, a woman who signs up to protect her country is more likely to be raped by a fellow soldier than to be killed by enemy fire. Mm-hmm. Those are pieces that you have to kind of wrestle with, as well as books called The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq by Helen Benedict. And many books have been written over the years about these things. And we have more questions to probe in this. We are joined here in studio, Dr. Marianne Githens, you just heard, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Goucher College. Greg Jacob, former Marine officer, Policy Director for Service Women's Action Network, SWAN. Captain Laurie Manning, retired U.S. Naval captain and Project Director of the Women's Research and Education Institute, Women in Military Project. In the Military Project, and Dr. Bruce Fleming, professor in the Department of English at the U.S. Naval Academy. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can join us here by Facebook and tweet us at Mark Steiner. Write to steinershow@gmail.com. Laurie, could you like to jump in on where we left off as well?
Yes. I would like to say a couple of things. One, most men in the military do not rape or assault women or other men.
Correct.
That often gets left out. So something is going right with them. The men who are doing this are not anywhere near the majority. They're a small percentage. So it's not something that is running rampant through the entire male population of the military. Secondly, I would say that over the years I've observed that any time a particular kind of unit is going to get women integrated into it for the first time, there is usually within the members of that particular community a sudden defense of, well, women can't do this, because it's been my observation that men in a unit that's about to be integrated somehow feel perhaps that they are losing face in front of men who are in units that are not about to be integrated, and that a lot of the angst over women coming into the unit has nothing to do with the women per se, as much as keeping the same status as men in all male units have. I mean, it seems to me sometimes there's something about
status among men involved that has nothing to do with women.
Hmm. Bruce, what do you think about that?
Well, what I can't emphasize enough that for a lot of men in the military, it's all about the brotherhood, it's all about the male bonding, it's all about the bromance, whatever you want to call it. To a much greater degree than most civilians understand, the military is under certain circumstances more akin to a football locker room than it is to an office culture. So part of what bothers me about the way all of this has been responded to by the civilian world is the misconception that the military works just the way an office works. In an office, everybody keeps his or her clothes on. You leave at 5 o'clock. You have your life. They have their life. But that's not, at its most extreme, that's not the military. There are things in the military that are like that. But being on a ship, for example, I mean, I was interested by the earlier discussion we were having with your caller. Those people are not supposed to be having sex with each other. He almost seemed to be saying, well, if you can get some of your aggression out with the girls on board, then you don't have so much of it left for the bordellos outside of Subic Bay. But it's completely illegal doing that. So it is absolutely true that men are doing it for other men. I mean, I go on about this to my students. I mean, they go to the gym. They say curls for girls, you know, but work out their biceps. But I say, no, it's buys for guys. We're all doing it to impress other guys and to one-up the other guys. That's part of our aggression. It's not just towards women. It's towards other men. So, of course, that's true. But as a P.S. with the devil dog, I appreciate what Greg is saying there, but his response is a quintessentially Marine Corps response, which I love and respect, but it's, I'm going to bust the heck out of these guys if they don't do what I say. But that's exactly the wrong way to go, because these guys don't, they don't own, as we say in the military, they don't own the protection of women. And that, for me, is the bottom line here. You have to explain it to them so that they understand that these women are essentially in their protection. If all you do is just bust the heck out of them when they step out of line, they're going to find ways to step out of line. That's just what men do. It's what human beings do. So it's a complete misconception for the civilian world to think, oh, these men, they're just horrible because they're not acting the way they would act in offices. The military is not an office culture.
Greg, I mean, your name was called out. Let me go to you first.
Well, you know, I spent a tour as an integrated company commander at the School of Infantry, and the Marines have an ethos that every Marine is a rifleman. So no matter what your job is, whether you're a butcher, a baker, or a candlestick maker, at some point during a battle, you're going to have to put your typewriter down and pick up a rifle and either repel an assault or participate in some sort of an armed action. So to augment that philosophy, the Marines send every non-infantry job to a 30-day combat course. And I was a company commander of an integrated combat company. So when I showed up, I had previously spent all my time in the Marine Corps and the infantry community, so I'd never trained with women. I'd never been they keep the infantry Marines on the other side of the base, in isolation. So the only time you see women is when you're at the PX or when you're out in town. And so when I showed up, half of my training cadre were women. My first sergeant was a woman, my executive officer was a woman, half of my staff NCOs and NCOs were women. And I was pushing about 450 students through that class every 30 days, and about half of those were women. So I had between 200 and 225 women students that were my responsibility and that were in my care. And it was very much a culture shock. I would definitely agree with what Lori was saying, and that those there were two integrated companies on that entire base, and they were basically looked at, you know, rather snidely and rather, you know, the other grunt COs would kind of look down their nose, and, you know, that we were sort of like playing Marine or we were doing these other types of things. And it was a very, you know, and it was incumbent on me to advocate for my Marines. It was incumbent for me to make sure that they were being put up for the proper promotion boards and that they were receiving the awards, just like if it were a male-only integrated company. So that was really what affected my position on women in the Marine Corps. And the other thing was that, you know, the performance of those Marines, the women that I served with, were absolutely phenomenal. And I, you know, I think, you know, when we start discussing standards-based training, we start discussing, you know, what you know, are women as strong as men? Can they do what men do? You know, the women that I serve with, I set a single standard for the entire company. The men were expected to perform at a certain level, and the women were expected to perform at the same level. And what I saw was I saw the women training. I saw the women, you know, going to the gym, learning the skills necessary to perform at that single standard level. So my personal experience has really informed my advocacy work at SWAN and my position around this issue, you know, as a whole. I mean, in terms of what the professor was saying about, you know, simply just, you know, frying folks if they step out of line, I mean, that's really the wrong approach. But that is really what the system has given the commanders. I mean, those are the tools that are in the toolbox. And the, you know, the mantra that I used to use is that if the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, then all your problems start to look like nails. So I think the military needs to do a better job of empowering commanders to discipline their troops in ways that are outside of this punitive type of mentality.
So let me ask you all this question. I'll be very frank about a couple of questions here. And I was thinking with some of what Bruce was saying and the others are saying as well. But if we are in a world now where more and more women are going to be integrated almost at every level of the armed forces. There are a few that have not opened up yet, but almost every level of armed forces, including combat. And not that women have not been in combat. I mean, women who drove trucks and were in the middle of battles in Iraq and Afghanistan. But that anybody who grew up in the Vietnam era, the military experience was a male experience. Completely. It was there were women, but it was a male experience. But now we're in this different world. Women have, especially since the 1960s and beyond, the world of women's rights has exploded. Women are in leadership across the country and across the planet in many ways that never happened before. So that when that happens, there's a consciousness that rises among women about certain rights that men didn't accept for eons and eons, including our right to have our way with women sexually, which is what is in many men's heads. I'm talking about heterosexual men. And so we are at a different – now we're in a very different place when it comes to being in the military where you are there to be aggressive. You are there to be prepared to fight a war. And now you're going to be able, now you're going to fight a war with a woman next to you if you're a man and vice versa. So this is a very different set of circumstances. And maybe part of the problem, Lori Manning, is that the culture of the world in general has pushed the military to a place where it's never been before, and part of the reason we're seeing what we're seeing is that no one is quite ready for it, or knows how to handle it, nor where the change is leading. Lori Manning.
Well, I would say women have been in combat throughout history.
That's true.
Look at the Soviet Union in World War II. They essentially ran out of men.
That's true.
There were women in ground combat. They were flying wooden biplanes for bombing runs over Germany. We know women can do it.
Right.
So we need not to blame women. Also,
I'm not blaming women.
The phenomenon of women in the military isn't a U.S. phenomenon. It's going on in countries everywhere because we need the women there. We need the women that are in Afghanistan. They are a plus because only women can get intelligence from the local women. We would be in a much poorer position without the women we have in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the problem isn't the women. It's that we need the women there. So how do we make changes to the military culture while
right.
keeping its basic ability to do its job intact? And that's the problem.
Well, I guess what I was saying, Lori Manning, I didn't want to be misunderstood. I wasn't blaming women.
I know you weren't.
Yeah, I'm saying that the change in the nature of our society has forced a change in the military and everywhere else. And I think men and male-dominated cultures, period, have not caught up with the change that's happening on the planet.
Right.
That's
and
what I'm saying.
That's the crux of the problem, I think, that we need to find a way, without alienating the men, to let them to get them to accept the fact the world has changed, women are going to be doing things that they haven't been doing, and it's for the good of society, it's for the good of the country. we need them there doing those things.
And so, go ahead, Miriam. But I do want to hear Bruce Fleming's response, because I thought you were in some way saying Bruce the opposite of that. But let me go, because it looks like you want Miriam to let you say something, and we'll go right to Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I was trying to say before, that it's the culture is the issue, but beneath the culture is really the question of appropriate gender roles. I mean, that women can do it. I mean, we somehow or the other, somehow the culture has to begin to deal with that. It has, I think, in the broader society, began to deal with that somewhat. And we see, I think, over the course of the years, some real improvements. And I think that the military has to begin to deal with that. But as long as there continue to be really quite stereotypic gender roles current in military thinking about appropriate roles, then in some ways the issue of sexual abuse will continue. And I think also it has to be related to the issue of power, because when you talk about unequal power, when we began this program, Mark said something about racism and Western European colonialism and so forth and its impact. And that too was really related to maldistribution of power, and in some ways the issue of abusive behavior has to deal with a question about equalizing somehow distributions of power.
So does something inside the military have to change then, Bruce Fleming? Because we are in a different world. This is not the world of curls for girls, as you talked about a moment ago. We're in a different place.
Clausewitz, the classic theoretician, Prussian theoretician of war, is very clear that war is about getting the enemy to do what you want him to do.
Right.
It is about power. So it is a power act. And it's pie in the sky. I like the word poppycock, so I'll borrow it here. It's poppycock to say we're going to have a military that has no aspect of aggression, a military that has no aspect of power. And it's also asking the tail to wag the dog to say we're going to go for some notion about what gender roles ought to be in society by remaking the military. The military works for the civilian world. We pay them. They work for us. Their job is to protect us. So it's a complete misunderstanding of who's doing what for whom to say we're going to change gender roles in society by changing them in the military. And it's also complete poppycock to say that you'll be able to erase this aspect of male aggressivity and have young men join voluntarily. I mean, we have, I'd like to remind us that we have an all-volunteer force. So
right.
Postulate a world where we have McGender, where there's no notion that the male role is to go out and fight or the male role. See, men actually think that they're doing something for the women. I mean, that's the problem with the old paradigm. They were the ones that were protecting their families. They went out and you know, killed the intruder and so on, and the women were supposed to be grateful. Of course, the women don't accept that, but the men get very aggrieved when it's suggested that the men are doing it in order to wreak their will on the women. They say, no, no, we're doing this for you. So that's a misconception that also needs to be understood. But if you, in a world of an all-volunteer force, you just will not get the young men signing up if it's suggested to them that it's a completely gender-neutral situation. Now, the good news is, just throw this in, it may be that some of our problems are going to solve themselves. Let me explain. The president has made clear that we're moving towards a kind of military at two speeds, to borrow a phrase that was used about the European community. On one hand, we have a lot of cultures, a lot of things in the military where we're not fighting D-Day again. You talked about D-Day before. A lot of times what we're doing is manning drones. Flying drones from an Air Force base in Nevada. We're on ships that don't actually come under active fire and so on. That's the majority of what we do now in the world. On the other hand, we have these special forces things. I mean, the president was very clear that increasingly we're going to be using these strike forces. Now, I think that you can, to a large degree, gender neutralize the first group. You cannot, under any way, shape, or form, and I'd like to be categorical about this,
yes,
gender neutralize the second.
So that's an interesting point. So let's talk, because I want to lead to a question, but I want Greg to respond to this as well, about you cannot gender neutralize the operations of extreme combat that we're talking about with special forces and other operations, and also the question of whether or not you can – how you separate gender and sexuality when it comes to being in the military. Greg, let me let you jump first. We have about 9 minutes left, folks. But go ahead, Greg.
Okay. Well, I mean, the idea that there's some binary paradigm in combat really is not the case. I mean, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, the battlefield has become asymmetrical. It's no longer linear. So there's no longer sort of a front and a middle and a rear type of area. There's, you know, there's the forward edge of the battle area, and then there's like everything else that's going on. And that's true even in special operations roles. Even when you get off of sort of this large scale, over the tank combat on the plains of Europe kind of stuff. If you get into really small operations and special operations, you know, the Marines have developed a doctrine called the three-block war, which basically means that a unit that's engaged in either special operations or in small combat operations will find that within a three-block area of the town that they're in, there'll be full-scale firefights going on one block, nothing happening on the other block, and on the other block there'll be humanitarian operations going on. So everybody that's in that environment has to be able to fight at any sort of at any level. And the three-block war can progress from absolutely nothing happening to a furious firefight in a matter of seconds. So there's really not a binary type of situation where we can group certain people in certain jobs and certain MOSs and then expect to be able to engage in the types of smaller scale operations that that are going on now.
But Lorraine Manning, the question that and then I'm going to get back to Marianne here, but the question that Bruce raised about there's going to be a different future because of the way the military is going to be occupied in terms of the special forces and the role they play. Women have no role in that. How does that play into all that?
Special forces, in fact, in both Afghanistan and Iraq have been leading the way in at least bringing women into their operations. They know the world has changed, and they know they need women for the intelligence gathering function, for instance, and they want the ability to bring women into their operations on an ad hoc basis, at least, even after Iraq and Afghanistan is gone. And I do want to point out that when I talk about gender integration in the military and cultural changes, I am not saying that the military needs to be less aggressive. It has to be aggressive. It's not a question of feminizing men. It's more a question of teaching women to be aggressive. And there are a number of men who simply can't adjust to that. Women can be aggressive. Talk to any of the young women who have served over in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're quite aggressive. And that throws some men, not all of them, but it does throw some of them.
Marianne?
Well, I mean, I'm a very optimistic person, but what Bruce said has really totally depressed me, because it seems to me what he's saying that is that if we want to be – if the country and our security is important and we need it military to protect it, then we just have to kind of overlook sexual abuse in the military. And that's – I mean, if that's really what you're saying, I think that's interesting.
I started off by saying that I completely condemn actions that are clearly sexual abuse. So you play by the rules. Come on, Professor.
No, you know – I mean, they're not playing by the rules now, are they? The person, the head, the one who was supposed to look into sexual abuse, has turned out to be a sexual abuser. Are you really kidding?
You're not saying that I condone that, are you?
No, I don't think Bruce was saying that.
But I think the implications are quite clear.
Bruce, go ahead.
I'd prefer not to bite on that one. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I've made it very clear that the military. I mean, I like Greg's term about the bright line between behavior that we really, I'm adding a little bit to what he says, but we have to be very clear about what the behavior is that's completely unacceptable. And to go back to my idea of what I call a no-fly zone, men have to, the way to solve the problem is to get men to feel the same responsibility for the people under their care that Greg felt when he was in command of his unit. And that cannot be done by coming in and telling men that they're bad for being male, that they're bad for wanting bromance, that they're bad for being aggressive.
No, but
who's doing that?
The training is doing that.
So the question is, I guess we have like 4 minutes we have left. I think that do we think, Lorraine Manning, that we can create a military where the question of gender and sexuality can be separated and work?
Well, we're
working on it, and so are most militaries around the world. And sooner or later, it's going to be... You can't do it overnight. You can't do it on a U-turn. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes respect for everybody involved who has to make changes in the process. And it takes time. It might take 2-3 generations. I'm not sure.
So what happens now with the men who have been accused of sexual assault in the military? What should happen at this point, Greg?
Well, right now the military is. You know, the military regulates itself under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And right now, the way in which these cases are handled typically is that the commander of the accused is the person who controls the doors to the courthouse, controls the investigation, controls the selection of the jury, and in the end can actually overturn whatever that court decides. So really to deal with this in a way that treats sexual assaults as crimes, that establishes that bright line that Bruce and I are talking about, is basically to put a system in place that's objective, impartial, and has prosecutors deciding what goes to trial rather than the individuals that are in charge of leading those offenders. So there's legislation in the pipeline that would do just that. And the military and the Secretary of Defense has already taken a stand on a couple of issues with regard to commander authority within the judicial process, particularly on this issue of overturning cases. So we're starting to see even the judicial system within the military change as a result of the military's response to sexual assault.
So do we think in these 2 minutes we have left that this is something that's larger than just a simple policy question, that in terms of changing culture, you were saying it could take generations, Laurie. Is that a conclusion we all agree with?
Well, I think we can fix 40% of it right now I think everybody that has spoken who has exposure to the training agrees that stuff's got to go. And what that means is rather than a top-down, punitive, men are bad, you keep it in your pants kind of training, it has to be explaining to them what women are doing there, explaining to them. I mean, any man will be protective of his sister, of his mother, of the females that he's... But, men are not, you know, we're not Andrea Dworkin, to the contrary. We're not trained to go after anything in a skirt. So they just have to explain to the men that these women are your responsibility. I mean,
well, I'm sorry, because I only have like a minute left. Yeah. And Laurie, I'd like to get a final thought on that from you after what you...
Well, I think I don't want to be any man's responsibility.
Right.
Most women in the military want to be seen as peers, as equals. And,
exactly.
I think we have to train all leaders, from the youngest enlisted people up, that the men and women, both the men and women working for them, are their responsibility. Their care comes first. That's always been the creed of the military, but we've lost it.
Well, I want to thank all of you
for
being.
Exactly,
this has been a fascinating conversation, and I appreciate all the openness in this conversation. Captain Laurie Manning, retired Captain Project Director of the Women's Research and Education Institute's Women in the Military Project. Dr. Bruce Fleming, Professor of English at the Naval Academy. Dr. Marion Githens, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Goucher College. And Greg Jacob, former Marine Policy Director of Service Women's Action Network, SWAN. Thank the four of you so much for this conversation. And we're going to take a very brief break, and we will examine President Barack Obama's words directed at black graduates. What do they mean? Stay with us.